Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. The birds and the bees, all right? So I'm going to start off kind of whimsically. That's a concept that is perennial. It goes on for generations. Everybody knows what the birds and the bees is about. It's, you know, kind of a happy, nice image of nature. And it's sort of a bedrock image of nature, really. But lately, birds have been falling dead out of the sky. And a couple of years ago, I started hearing about the disappearance of honeybees, too. I mean, I'd noticed that bees were no longer buzzing around our flowers and pollinating our citrus trees in our yard as they had for years and years. And I wondered about that, and then I started seeing there were various theories about why bees were disappearing. Cell phones and things like that, they seem far-fetched to me, and just in general, nothing I heard seemed very convincing. But I did want to know what was happening to bees and why. So that is the reason for our show today. I have, as my guest on American Variety, Dr. Jamie Ellis, who's an assistant professor of entomology at the University of Florida, and he's at the Honeybee Research and Extension Laboratory, so he is certainly an expert on bees and is internationally known in that field, and he's going to talk with us about what's happening to bees. Welcome, Jamie.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
So, what's happening?
Well, honeybees traditionally have had good populations in the United States. In about the 1940s, we were around 6 million honeybee colonies. Today, we have about 2.5 million, and when you graph that out over the last 60 or 70 years, it's been a fairly steady decline. About 2006, beekeepers began reporting abnormal losses. And when I say abnormal, it's fairly acceptable for beekeepers to lose about 10 to 20% of their colonies every year, which they're able to recreate the following year. But in 2006, beekeepers were reporting 30% and greater losses, and these losses were fairly unsustainable because it's fairly easy to recover 20% losses the following year, but once you cross that 30% mark, beekeepers really were noticing something they believed to not be sustainable. So we have this new phenomenon coming on that very quickly became termed colony collapse disorder, and that is what has taken the beekeeping industry, not only in the U.S., but globally, by surprise. Traditionally, honeybees have had a number of problems, but this colony collapse disorder seems to present with a unique series of symptoms specific to this phenomenon, and this is really what people are paying a lot of attention to right now.
So a couple things. When you say colony, are you talking about beehives in the wild or strictly about bees that beekeepers keep in boxes and make honey from and use commercially in other ways? I mean, what were the colonies that were collapsing?
Primarily, we are talking about commercial colonies, colonies tied up in typical beekeeping operations. We have a suspicion, though it's not been verified, that this may be occurring in the wild as well, but most of our comments come from our knowledge of beekeepers losing their production colonies.
So it sounds like this was a pretty sudden onset of this phenomenon. I mean, as you say, there's always kind of a constant gradual turnover in bees. I don't know whether they die from disease or old age or what things, and we'll get into that, but this was a sudden real spike in the drop in population, I guess, in bees in the colonies. And so, is that right? I mean, it was real sudden?
Well, yes and no. It was sudden in that people began reporting it in a large-scale manner very suddenly. Back in 2006, it was, quote, the official time it first started in fall of 2006, but I remember years before that when I was working at the University of Georgia, I was discussing with a technician about this event happening in Alabama with bee colonies there, and they were talking about it. And the symptomology associated with those collapsing colonies in Alabama years and years ago matched almost exactly with what we were talking about in 2006 with the onset of colony collapse disorder. Hmm. So the hype and the level of attention and the level of notice that beekeepers have seen in their particular operations certainly is a new thing, 2006, but a lot of people believe that this has been going on for some period of time, possibly at levels that only pockets of beekeepers around the country noticed, but now it's become widespread enough to where people are talking about it and seeing this as a real issue that seems to not be going away.
Okay, so that makes sense. It's like a lot of phenomena that it suddenly ramps up in visibility as more and more people become aware of it. The more people become aware of it, the more people become aware of it, right?
So exactly. That's exactly what's happened here, exactly.
Well, all right. So when a colony collapses, what happens? Does it totally die and all the bees inside it are dead, or do they all disappear, or some of the bees are still there, but the population is just smaller, or what happens when a colony collapses in this colony collapse disorder?
Well, that's what makes this phenomenon fairly unique. If you've kept bees or been around beekeeping for any length of time, you'll realize that there are a number of things that kill honeybees, and you alluded to the fact that we'll be talking about those shortly. But to say that we understand the symptomology associated with those traditional bee pests and diseases is true. We know what to expect when those things are in colonies. However, with colony collapse disorder, it presents with a fairly unique series of symptoms. And the symptoms associated with it is that you have an otherwise healthy-looking colony dwindle in population very quickly, over a very short period of time. And often, the bees that are lost, their bodies are not on the outside of the colony. You don't see dead bees in the box. You don't see dead bees outside the box. They just disappear. In fact, initially when it came out, people were calling it disappearing disease or dwindling disease. So there seems to be a very sudden loss in colony population that can happen over a very short period of time. And one of the things that's key to this is if you go into a colony that is in the process of collapsing, people tend to notice that the colony is made up primarily of younger bees rather than old bees. And the reason that's important, it's younger bees stay in the colony and do the colony work. Older bees are the ones that go out of the nest and forage and collect nectar and pollen. So people begin to suggest that whatever's happening is happening to this older generation of bees and that very quickly spilling over to the younger generation before the ultimate colony collapse. And coupled with the fact that we don't have bee bodies to do autopsies on. So there's this unique series of symptoms associated with this particular issue.
But I mean, I guess you're talking worldwide about billions of bees, so they're not being found dead in any numbers? They're just, I mean, what happens to bees that leave the colony or the hive or whatever? I mean, do they just fly around lonely themselves? I mean, there's large amounts of bees, right? What happens to them?
Exactly. That's kind of the interesting part about this whole thing. In a normal situation, when a honeybee dies, if she dies in the hive, there are bees in the colony who are undertaker bees, and those bees will literally grab that bee and they will remove it some distance away from the colony, perhaps 40 feet or greater. And furthermore, when a colony is dwindling down or an old bee is out in the field foraging and its time has come, it may just die in the field. So in a typical situation, we do not notice the dead bees because they're either taken away from the colony or they die out in the field and never make it back. But in situations associated with other pests and pathogens, the number of dead bees outpaces the number of bees that are cleaning them out. So some of these other pests and pathogens, we start to see a buildup of carcasses perhaps inside the box on the bottom or just outside the box on the ground because there's a lot of dead bees being generated. In CCD, though, in colony collapse disorder, we don't have that. And making this unique issue is this particular symptom. We don't really know. And there have been people wanting to know where those carcasses are going, what's happening to the dead bees, but it's really led to the generation of a lot of theories that perhaps these older bees are being affected. They're wandering away from the colonies and their typical behavior and losing their ability to find their colony again, to come back to their colony. Yeah, that's one of the hypotheses supporting this particular loss of bees, but otherwise it's a conundrum that's really got a lot of scientists scratching their heads.
Well, as I mentioned at the outset, my wife and I have a pretty large yard and heavily landscaped, and we have lots of flowers and flowering trees and, you know, citrus trees that flower during the spring and that kind of thing. And we've done that on purpose in a way to have some berms that are butterfly gardens, and they also attract bees. And so I used to see, you know, at times dozens of bees buzzing around, and I see almost none now. Occasionally I'll see a bumblebee and occasionally one honeybee. So it's still a mystery. Well, you're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Jamie Ellis, a bee expert from the University of Florida. He's an entomologist, about the mysterious disappearance of bees. And so let's kind of shift gears a little bit, Jamie, and talk about how many kinds of bees are there? We've been talking about honeybees here so far, but how many kinds of bees are there in the world, roughly?
Well, in Florida alone, for example, where I live, there's 315 plus or minus a handful of species of bees, of which only one of those is the honeybee.
Yeah.
So, you know, across the planet, we have thousands of species of bees. So bees are pervasive everywhere. But the one that we rely most on for our pollination efforts, of course, are honeybees. And the ones that we use all belong to a single species of honeybee, which is Apis mellifera.
So is this thing happening to honeybees around the world?
Well, I'm on an international committee in Europe, and a lot of my colleagues there mention monumental or escalated honeybee losses, but a lot of my colleagues will stop short of calling it CCD. What they claim is that in many of their cases that there are identifiable culprits behind their losses, but that they are elevated nonetheless. But in addition to that, there are a number of other colleagues I have who confess in their country that they believe they're seeing CCD. But CCD, as we know it, at least at the level that we're seeing it, tends to be what we believe an American phenomenon, though there's similarities with some other losses around the world. But this is a pretty significant issue. There are people all over the globe looking into honeybee losses and pollinator losses in general, and I think the presence of CCD in the U.S. has really brought attention to it and is what's the impetus behind this massive search for what might be going on with pollinators in general.
What are the main stresses on bees? I mean, let's start with, like, parasites, for example. What are some of the possible culprits for this thing? Let's talk about parasites and pests.
Yeah, well, so I've been a beekeeper now for about 21 years, and I can tell you that when you first train to be a beekeeper, parasites and pests are the things that they talk to you about the most. I can think of a handful of mites that get on or in honeybees. For example, even with colony collapse disorder, varroa mites remain the number one killer of honeybees on the planet. And a varroa mite is a mite, much like a tick, that gets on the outside of the bee and pierces the bee's integument and sucks its blood or its hemolymph. And that mite can pass the viruses to the bee. Now, there's a tracheal mite that lives in the tracheal system of bees. There are beetles, small hive beetles, that can get into honeybee colonies and kill colonies. So there are a handful of pests and parasites. But really, the biggest threats as a group to our bees are the pathogens, and that's where we run into things like viruses and bacteria. They get fungal diseases, et cetera. Mm. So these parasites and pathogens and pests are the traditional things that beekeepers are taught to look for and to attempt to manage in their beekeeping operations.
And will those things, the diseases and the parasites and the pests, will they typically wipe out an entire colony or just infect some of them? Or do the bees kind of clean it out, or are some immune to it? Or, you know, what goes on with that?
Well, all of the above. The interesting thing, let's just pick varroa mites, for example. I share with you that varroa mites are the number one killer of honeybees on the planet. Well, varroa mites can very quickly wipe out entire colonies, but there's a symptomology associated with varroa damage that we can recognize as varroa damage. And you can breed bees that are resistant to varroa. There are lots of things that you can do for varroa mites. For some of these pathogens, for example, these bacterial pathogens that affect immature honeybees, we know what to see, we know how to treat it, we know how to deal with it. We can breed bees for resistant to it. With that said, there are strains of bees that are highly susceptible to some of these things. So the key in the research world is to breed bees or find bees that are quite resistant to these various things. But when you consider one pest, a colony typically can handle one pest or one pathogen. But then when you begin to have additive effects between multiple pests or multiple pathogens or pests and pathogens, that's when colonies tend to get stressed in ways that they seem unable to overcome these issues that they could overcome if there was only one of these things affecting it at a time.
Yeah. I think you said that you often find that the older bees that forage out are disappeared or presumed dead, missing in action or whatever, and that the younger bees that typically stay in the colony are still alive in there. But do you get situations where all of the bees then, I mean, I would think that the varroa mite and different pests like that would affect all of the bees without prejudice. And
some of these do, but if you consider pathogens, for example, the longer a bee lives, in theory, the more pathogen load it's going to have in its body. So, younger bees, as they grow up, you've got this pathogen level increasing. Varroa mites, on the other hand, you're right, you would expect them to be indiscriminate and just go across the board and affect all bees equally, unless, of course, you consider the fact that varroa mites are putting pathogens into the bodies of bees. So this thing about bees going out into the field and possibly being the ones that die, you have to remember, when a bee leaves a colony, it leaves the parasites and pathogens that it's been exposed to forever and going into a world where there's a unique series of stressors that are out there. Mm-hmm. So the older a bee gets, the more it is exposed to the things that could otherwise kill it. So even though a lot of the bee pests and diseases are fairly indiscriminate, the moment that bee leaves the colony, all bets are off. There's all kinds of things that it can happen to it in the outside world.
So I guess one of the biggest of those threats to it in the outside world is pesticides. And, of course, you know, mankind's been using pesticides and insecticides and so on and various things on plants and the kind of flowers that bees feed on for decades, for generations. Is there a thinking that pesticides are a big factor in colony collapse disorder, maybe?
Well, there are large contingencies of people who believe them to be. I personally believe that they're in a long list of stressors that they could be contributing, even possibly significantly, to colony losses, but that they're probably not solely responsible for what we're seeing. Let me give you an example. A single honeybee colony can forage 3 to 5 miles in any direction from its nest. So a single honeybee comes out of that colony, she can forage up to 5 miles. The area of a circle that has a 5-mile radius is 78 to 79 square miles of area. That means a single honeybee colony can cover 78 square miles of area. And, of course, in that 78 square miles, there are a range of pesticides being used that bees could be exposed to in the field and bring back to the colony. There have been people and studies that have looked specifically at pesticide loads in colonies, and of course, they've found a range of pesticides, which includes insecticides and herbicides and fungicides in honeybee colonies at levels that could, in theory, damage them. But even if pesticides aren't killing the bees outright, it's possible that they affect bees in other ways that might compromise the immune system. But you could say the opposite is true. Maybe the bee already has a virus, which makes it more susceptible to pesticides. So it becomes a chicken and egg argument, which is the primary cause and which is a secondary stressor. So yes, they get exposed to pesticides in the field. Yes, there's a large contingency of people who believe that they're significant contributors to colony losses, but right now we just don't understand the role that they're playing in colony demise overall.
Yeah, and again, I would think that, you know, because pesticides have been in use for so long, really there's probably more control over pesticide use than there was 40, 50 years ago when DDT was around and that kind of thing, things that were, you know, much more powerful toxins that were used almost indiscriminately. And so I don't know, you know, but I can see the additive cumulative effect is probably playing a part here in the picture of it. Let me ask you this. Do the queens die?
Queens are usually the last ones to go down with a ship, so to speak, with honeybee colonies. And one of the symptoms of CCD is that as a colony is dwindling, the queen still tends to be present. So it could be just an issue that the worker bees are in there taking care of her along the way, and that she just dies ultimately when there's not enough bees to maintain that critical mass that recognized as a colony. So, yes, they don't tend to go out early in the game, but they certainly tend to go out as the colony gets down to that very low dwindling phase.
You mentioned that nobody really knows whether this is going on as much with hives in the wild. So with bees that are in beekeepers' commercial colonies, isn't there a lot of inbreeding that would go on? And is that maybe a factor here, too?
Absolutely. You know, if you look from the 1940s until now, like I shared with you earlier, we've got about 2.5 million honeybee colonies in the U.S., and there is a segment of the beekeeping industry whose job it is to produce queen bees who ultimately supply those to all the beekeepers across the country. So even if I'm not purchasing queen bees, my colonies were originally started from someone who did purchase queen bees. So ultimately, every bee in the U.S. is related to this series of bees that these queen producers keep. There have been some genetic analyses out there to suggest that the number of breeder queens and queen breeding operations is somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,500 to 2,000 queens that overall support the 2.5 million queens and honeybee colonies that we have in the U.S. So some suggest that what we have is simply a genetic bottleneck where there's very few producing the large number of queens and bees that we have. So effectively, some suggest that we just keep a monoculture of bees, and monocultures by definition are very susceptible to pests and diseases. Others, on the other hand, argue that even though we have 1,500 to 2,000 breeder queens, there's still enough genetic diversity there to not be too worried at this moment. So that the jury's still out on that. There's clear evidence that biodiversity is lacking here, but we really need to look at that further.
Well, thinking outside the bee box here, do people go out and look for wild hives and then try to breed them into the captive colonies to give some more diversity to the gene pool?
Some do. There's not a lot of it going on at a commercial level. Commercial beekeepers oftentimes are tied up with thousands of colonies. So to go out and find individual wild colonies and hope to use that in a way that would be meaningful to them, it's very difficult. But I know that there are researchers around the country who've begun to look at this, as well as some sideliner or hobbyist beekeepers who do that. One of the things you've got to remember, though, is in the 1980s when varroa mites came, varroa mites all but domesticated the honeybee in the U.S. If you didn't keep the colony and work with it to control varroa mites, it was fairly guaranteed that it would die. And because of that, we lost a significant population of wild honeybees starting in the 1980s to varroa mites. So you could argue that all the honeybees that are out there in the wild now are ones that have simply left our colonies and repopulated the wild. So there may not be as much diversity out there as we would hope.
Interesting. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with entomology professor Jamie Ellis at the University of Florida, who's with the Honeybee Research and Extension Laboratory there, about the mysterious disappearance of bees, honeybees, worldwide, but particularly in the United States, which is getting to be a big phenomenon. It has a lot of potential impacts. So what's being done about it then? I mean, it sounds like there's just sort of a a lot of scrambling around and a lot of research trying to figure out what's going on, but so far no real countermeasures to it. What do you think's happening?
So there's really two fronts or two groups of people, probably more, but two groups of people that are intimately involved with it. A group of people, number one, are beekeepers. Obviously, they're the ones who are losing colonies, and their response to it has been, there are some things in beekeeping that we can control, so they're trying to up their ability to control those things to remove potential stressors that may contribute to the overall cause. For example, varroa mites. We're working better to control varroa mites, or we're working to mitigate management stresses, etc. Beekeepers also are having to amplify their efforts at making new colonies. So let's say traditionally the historical loss percentages are 20%. If I have 100 colonies this year, I'll have 80 next year. And most beekeepers were able to make up those losses the following year. But now I can't, because with CCD around, I've got 30 to 35% losses. And so every year my numbers go further and further down. So beekeepers are trying to increase the number of colony splits they make. But certainly that's not sustainable over the long haul. So beekeepers are doing a number of things to increase the number of colonies they have, control the diseases and pests and things that they can control. But I must say, researchers are really, really, really working hard at trying to figure out what this is. One of the things about CCD that I suppose you could say is a good thing is that it has freed up a lot of grant money to study the plight and peril of pollinators. So our federal government, state governments, multiple associations, beekeeper associations, things such as the National Honey Board and the North American Pollinator Protection Campaign, things just like that, are now offering grants where researchers can begin to investigate the cause of CCD. And right now, the leading hypothesis as a cause for CCD is really multiple stressors. No one at this point believes there's any single cause. So because of that, we've got researchers studying pathogens, the effects of pesticides on bees. We've got researchers studying the management stresses on bees. So one of the things that's come out of a result of these colony losses are just a large increase in the amount of funding and the amount of research on what we know does kill honeybees and trying to mitigate those things that we can. People now are beginning to look at that second tier level approach, which is looking at the interactions between these multiple stressors. So there's a lot of work going on right now between government agencies, all the way to beekeepers, to scientists, even to homeowners, try to help this situation out, really, to make our bees healthier.
So the fact that there's a lot of research money suddenly coming into bees and how to keep them alive reflects the fact that bees are important. So why do we need bees?
That's one of the things we always think about when we go into academia and we study something that people believe to be pretty insignificant. So I'm a honeybee researcher, and 5 years ago that wouldn't have meant much to many people, but now, with honeybees out and the declines going on, people are beginning to understand why they're important and why we need research just like this. So why are they important? Well, it's very simple. Honeybees, when they leave a colony, collect one of four things. Number one, they collect water, or they'll collect nectar, which is basically sugar water that flowers produce to attract bees, and with that nectar they produce honey. The third thing they collect is they'll collect plant rhizomes, or what we call in the beekeeper world is propolis, which is a sticky substance that they'll use in their colonies. But the fourth thing that they collect is pollen. Bees collect pollen because they consume it. They're not collecting pollen purposely to help plants. They're collecting pollen because they need it to survive. With pollen, bee colonies are able to make new bees. Because they need pollen, they go to flower to collect it, to bring it back to their colony. And in the process of doing that, the flowers are pollinated. Because flowers are pollinated, the flower then can produce fruits, vegetables, nuts, berries, etc. Long story short, their effort to get pollen leading to pollination ultimately produces a lot of the food that humans globally consume. There have been estimates out there that 10 to 20% of every bite of food that we eat come directly from the pollination efforts of honeybees. And that's pretty easy to see when you think about things like blueberries and strawberries and cucumbers and squash and watermelons. But when you consider the fact that honeybees are very responsible for pollinating clover and alfalfa so that growers can have seed to plant more clover and alfalfa, you'll quickly appreciate that clover and alfalfa are important cattle fodder crops. So honeybees are even in a way responsible for perpetuating the dairy industry and the meat industry, etc. So you really gain an appreciation for what honeybees do for us and how vitally important they are to not only our food supply in the United States, but really the food supply globally. And that's why people are paying attention. They're beginning to realize how honeybees are a keystone, fundamental species in production agriculture, a species that we simply cannot do without.
I know that one big industry and an important part of agriculture is that beekeepers take their hives around. They don't just make honey out of these boxes that are sitting in fields, but they put them on flatbeds and then take them around to orchards and groves all over the country at the right time of the year as those plants and trees are flowering, and basically rent them out, rent the services of the bees out to pollinate those commercial crops. So that's a big industry. And are beekeepers surviving with this kind of thing going on? I guess it increases their costs is the main factor, and it also reduces the number of bees available.
That's exactly right. There's a handful of ways that beekeepers make money. Way number one is what most people think of when they think of honeybees, and that's producing honey. But really the value of honey in the United States is somewhere between $150 to $250 million every year. And that sounds like a lot. I grant you that. However, the value of pollination is estimated to be around $15 billion. So really, the honey production is really just a drop in the bucket of what's really important to us, which is pollination. So yes, beekeepers move their colonies all over the country. Of those 2.5 million honeybee colonies that are present in the United States, for example, 1.5 million of those every year go to pollinate the almond crops in California. So when you begin to think about things like that and then how those bees go from almonds to blueberries and from blueberries to watermelons, commercial beekeepers tell me that they expect about a 15% loss in colonies between every crop. And some commercial beekeepers in my state in Florida go to 4 to 5 different crops every year. So management stress is moving bees around to ensure our nation's food supply really can take its toll on bees. Absolutely.
Jamie, we have less than a minute left, but just very quickly, what would happen if all the honeybees disappeared? Would our human colony collapse?
If honeybees disappeared today, one of the things that we would lose immediately is we would lose what I call the flavor of our food. Now, if you hear what I'm talking about, you know, we have things like blueberries and strawberries and citrus and things like that. All those are very important commodities that we just enjoy to have in the developed countries that we live, but they're all insect-pollinated plants. They need honeybees. If we didn't have honeybees, a lot of those would dwindle, if not disappear altogether, and we would be stuck with a lot of wind-pollinated plants, the type of foodstuffs that you see sustaining third world countries like rice and wheat and corn, things like that. It can be done, but we would certainly lose the variety of our diet, and certainly there'd be long-term trickle-down effects. Food prices would be affected, et cetera. So we need honeybees to maintain the vibrant quality of life that we enjoy here as well as others enjoy around the globe.
Well, everybody listening, if you want to learn more about this important subject, you can go to ufhoneybeesingular.com or just Google University of Florida Bee Disease Videos, and that'll take you to the Extension Service, and you can actually see some videos of Jamie talking in more detail about some of the things we've been talking about. Dr. Jamie Ellis, thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety. This has been fascinating.
Absolutely. I really appreciate you inviting me to talk about this. It's very important for everyone. I just thank you for giving me the chance to talk about it.
Thanks again for being on, and thanks to all of you for listening, and I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.